Are we a declining race? An old sailor's verdict by Walter Hunt. Chapter 4. A remarkable example of decline. The largest company you could enroll, a single vessel could embark the whole. So few there are, the noble manly minds, faithful and firm, the men that honour binds, impregnable to danger and to pain, and lo, seduction in the shape of gain. By Theognis. There is perhaps nothing in the history of mankind which affords a more striking example of the rapid degeneration of a noble race than the fall of the Fijian native. 40 years ago, the Fijian might truly have been considered one of the finest specimens of natural manhood in the South Pacific Islands. Today, he is in danger of suffering the fate of the Tasmanian by going right out of existence. A brief example of his fall, conveying also some idea of his appearance and character in the days of his freedom, may be of advantage to us in the solution of our own all-important problem. Imagine a powerfully built man, about 6 feet in height, with intelligent expression of countenance, swarthy complexion, frizzy hair, which, when properly dressed, resembles a huge ball, some 3 to 5 feet in circumference, having a few crimson leaves inserted by way of decoration, a necklace of whale's teeth, with perhaps a large boar's tusk pendant on his chest, a cloth of native tapa round his waist, with a huge club artistically carved in his hand. There you have a fair representation of a Fijian native. Some idea of his immense strength of arm may be gained by a glimpse at the Fijian clubs to be seen at the British Museum. In character, he might be termed fearless and honourable. He would never attack an enemy without first sending word of his intention. He was truthful, honest in his transactions, chaste in his living. He was also affectionate in his domestic relations, although his method of showing his affection would lead a stranger to suppose that he was just the opposite. There was another side to his character which must not be overlooked. He was a cannibal, and one of the fiercest. He could also be very cruel to his victims, and club law was his only method of settling disputes. He was also superstitious. He had a certain veneration for snakes, and he believed in some sort of a future existence. One of his worst superstitions was that when a chief died, it was necessary that his wives should accompany him to the unknown world. Therefore, the wives were strangled and buried with him. This inhuman practice, or inhuman as it must appear to us, was one of the Fijian ways of showing affection. The wives, sincerely believing that they would live with their husbands in another state if they were buried with them, deemed their relatives unkind if this terrible duty was neglected, and in some cases they have been known to commit suicide deliberately rather than be left behind. Another peculiar method of showing affection was that when parents became old and decrepit, with no further prospects of enjoyment in life, their children, still exhibiting the deepest tokens of affection, would bury them alive. Instead of wearing crepe as a token of mourning, they would take a piece of shell and saw off one of their own finger joints. We now come to the most important part of their regime, the matrimonial. They had a system of polygamy by which the chiefs had 3 or 4 wives. In Fiji, a plurality of wives was looked upon as so much property, rather than as the means of gratifying the passions. Therefore, it was the best system which could have prevailed under all the circumstances. The chiefs were naturally the best men, and the race was propagated from the best stock, while the majority of the less perfect remained chaste. The term chaste may be applied here, I think, in its fullest sense. take the following from Vita, an account of a government mission to the Fijian Islands, by Bardolf Seaman, PhD, FLS, FRGS, as an example of village life. Quote, "The men sleep at the Buraniza, or stranger's house, those of about the same age sleeping together, while the boys, until they have been admitted publicly into the society of the adults, have a sleeping bure to themselves. It is quite against Fijian ideas of delicacy that a man ever remains under the same roof with his wife or wives at night. In the morning he goes home, and if not employed in the field, remains with his family the better part of the day, absenting himself as the evening approaches. Rendezvous between husband and wife are arranged in the depths of the forest, unknown to any but the two. After childbirth, husband and wife keep apart for 3 and even 4 years, so that no other baby may interfere with the time considered necessary for suckling children, in order to make them healthy and strong. This, in a great measure, explains the existence of polygamy. The relations of a woman take it as a public insult if any child should be born before the customary 3 or 4 years have elapsed, and they consider themselves in duty bound to avenge it in an equally public manner." Close quote. One could scarcely conceive of a more exemplary little community from its own moral standpoint. The sexual idea was scarcely known among the ordinary people. The rank and file of the village folk knew that the matrimonial state was beyond their scope, and they did not trouble their heads about it. Another reason for their not troubling about it was that adultery was a capital crime. Dr. Seaman tells us that Karaduadua clubbed one of his own nephews for being unduly intimate with one of his wives. Tokombu is said to have cut off the nose of one of his sisters for this offence. These people were very intelligent, as might be inferred from their mode of life. Not only were they satisfied with their own system, but they could see the weakness of ours. According to Dr. Seaman, one of them asked a white man how many brothers and sisters he had. The white man frankly answered him, 10. "But that could not be," was the rejoinder. "One mother could scarcely have so many children." Being told that these children were born at annual intervals, and that such occurrences were common in Europe, he was very much shocked, and thought it explained sufficiently why so many white men were mere shrimps. Here is a lesson in philosophy from the Cannibal Islands. It seems to me that the tables should have been turned, and instead of sending missionaries out there to convert the natives to our ideas, we should have sent men for the purpose of learning something from them, or at the most of making a friendly exchange of ideas. The Fijians were very much imposed upon at that time by the white settlers, and there were several disputes as to ownership of the land. On one occasion, the Americans had been keeping up the 4th of July, Yankee Day, as it is termed, the celebration being held at the house of the American consul. During the night, a fire broke out in some sheds that they used for drying bêche de mer, and they accused the natives of incendiarism. They held a court of inquiry and fined the king a certain amount of money, getting him to put his mark to a certain document. Seeing that the Fijians possessed no money, this was a bit of a farce. However, the fine, whatever the amount might have been, remained unpaid until, in the course of a few years, with the interest, it mounted to £9,000. Then, certain speculators formed a syndicate, which was to relieve the natives of this embarrassment. This precious scheme was termed the Polynesian Land Syndicate, or some such title, and its members agreed to pay the Americans out, to give a kakobau, £200 per annum, to each of his chiefs, a certain amount, and to assist kakobau in upholding and defending his kingdom. In return, they were to have 160,000 acres of land of their own choice, the sole right of levying duties on imports and exports with wharfage and harbour dues, the sole right of banking and issuing of banknotes, a preemptive right over all land which Cacabao might hereafter wish to sell, and full power to make laws for the good government and welfare of the natives and settlers at any time. By another clause, Cacabao was to clear and plant with Sea Island cotton for the said company without delay or charge, a certain amount of acres of the land at such places and times as the company should direct. Cacabao's mark was actually put to this document when another factor appeared in the shape of the British government. The claims of the Polynesian Company were ignored altogether. The Americans were paid out with $45,000, and the British government was to receive 200,000 acres of land of its own choosing. Thus were the natives involved in heavy obligations as a result of a calamity with which they, perhaps, had nothing to do. Such transactions generally lead to a lot of bloodshed, and the native always goes to the wall. There are several disturbances over the land question. In 1868, HMS Challenger sent a punitive force up the Rewa, consisting of 4 boats and 86 men, with 2 Armstrongs. Again, in 1873, there was a disturbance, with a slaughter of about 400. After many lives had been lost, Cacabao was persuaded to petition the British government to establish a protectorate over them, with the result that the Fijian Islands were annexed by us in 1874, under the direction of Sir Hercules Robinson, Governor of New South Wales at that time. Cacabao's speech will give some idea as to their condition at the time. Quote, "Any chief who refuses to cede cannot have much wisdom. If matters remain as they are, Fiji will become like a piece of driftwood on the sea, to be picked up by the first passer-by. The whites who have come to Fiji are a bad lot. They are mere stalkers on the beach. The wars here have been far more the result of interference of intruders than the fault of the inhabitants. Of one thing I am assured, that if we do not cede Fiji, the white stalkers on the beach, the cormorants, will open their maws and swallow us." Close quote. This does not redound much to the credit of the white stalkers on the beach. Still, it seems that the ultimate fate of the Kanaka in all those parts is to be swallowed up. As soon as the freedom of the natives was signed away, they were given to understand by the missionaries that they were now British subjects and that polygamy was illegal. The first thing they did, therefore, was to annul all the old polygamous marriages and distribute the women among all sorts and conditions of men. No doubt the missionaries thought they were doing quite right in this matter, but I ask, was it not a monstrous thing that they should have been allowed a free hand in matters of such vital importance as the breaking up of homes and systems without any other apparent means of discrimination other than their religious zeal? The Fijians had a system of domestic regulation that was truly marvellous, considering the state of savagery in which we found them. One might imagine that they had had some of the knowledge of ancient Greece, so similar were their customs of separating their sexes, public sleeping berths, and propagating the race from the best stock. Plato himself could scarcely have improved on the system. Would that there had been a Plato or a Lycurgus in the place of those missionaries. Their action in the breaking up of those homes was irremediable. When the mothers were dispersed, those young virgins who had been so jealously guarded by them were dispersed also, and there were not wanting those, not only natives, ready to take advantage of them, and their liberty was too quickly turned into license. Licentious ideas had already been introduced among some of the male population, and it did not require much persuasion to convert the whole group of islands into a huge agapemone. This universal matrimony was a new idea, and the lower orders took to it most readily. Many of those who were not physically so well favoured as others, and who had never entertained any ideas of marrying, suddenly found themselves confronted with the opportunity of taking a wife. Naturally, they lost no time in seizing it. It was a case of Marcus is willing, without any time lost on courtships, and they kept the missionaries quite busy for a time with the interesting ceremony. A lady in the governor's household wrote from Fiji to a friend, quote, "Today being Sunday, there has been much church going. After morning service, there were no less than 13 weddings. The superfluous wives are in much demand by men who hitherto have failed to secure domestic bliss." Close quote. In another letter, she wrote, quote, "So it happened that on reaching this place, Nirakurakuru, 3 days ago, we found no less than 40 couples belonging to this and the neighbouring villages, all waiting to be married on the arrival of the missionary." Close quote. From another place, she wrote, quote, "There is a perfect crowd of interesting young couples just coming in to be married, so I must watch the proceedings." Close quote. The ceremony itself, no doubt, seemed to be innocent enough, and very interesting both to the missionaries and to the onlookers who were in sympathy with them. Yet there were others who viewed these proceedings with far different feelings than those of approval. Pessimists, some perhaps will say, yet subsequent events showed that there was reason in their pessimism. I mentioned before that this universal matrimony was a new idea, and like all new ideas, it was carried to an extreme. Well, with what results? Within 12 months of the annexation, the Fijians were overtaken by a great calamity. An epidemic of measles ravaged the whole group of islands, carrying off some 40,000 natives. This was all the more significant, as such a disease as measles was quite new to them. Many of the more superstitious looked upon this as a judgment on them for changing their mode of life and giving up their lands, so they fled to the mountains, and some time and trouble were involved before they could be prevailed upon to return. Following the measles, they were attacked with catarrh, then with whooping cough among the children. These seemed to be but the commencement of their troubles, and when the census of 1881 was taken, it was found that the native population had decreased in numbers to the extent of about 50,000. The estimated population at the time of the annexation in 1874 was 150,000, and in 1897 the native population was 99,773. As the Europeans prospered in wealth, so the Fijians deteriorated in physique, until at length in 1893 it was found necessary to appoint a government commission to inquire into the cause of the decrease of the native population. What I have but hinted at here was fully borne out by the investigation. The methods adopted by the commissioners was the issuing of a circular note to all the principal Europeans and the native chiefs, soliciting their views on this subject. Some of the answers sent in were very suggestive of it being an entirely moral problem. As might be expected, the answers and opinions received varied a good deal. Some were very elaborate and wide of the mark, but others more simple and to the point. Kava drinking and tobacco smoking seemed to occupy the most attention. Kava used to be considered quite a harmless beverage, its chief effect being to induce sleep, while the use of tobacco, although not commendable, would scarcely lead to such disastrous results. A few of the letters, however, throw some light on the subject. On page 8 of the Commissioner's official report, we read, quote, "Four writers indicate as the primary cause the circumstances arising from the abolition of polygamy on the introduction of Christianity. Others cite that event, but only as a minor cause. One ascribes it to the more frequent bearing of children by the mothers. Another, that the mother is not so well cared for as under the old regime, when she was allowed 4 years to nurse her child and was relieved during that period of all domestic duties beyond nursing the baby, a system which placed the mother in the best possible position to rear her child. Monogamy prevents this, and the injurious nature of the change is emphasized by the fact that the Fijian has no possible substitute for mother's milk. That the women have now to rely, when in travail, on the good offices of some old woman, instead of being, as formerly, well looked after by the other female members of the household, who took as much interest in the unborn babe as the mother herself. That in polygamous times, the best females of the race bore children to the best males, and the progeny was consequently robust, but that many of such women are now the wives of an inferior class of men, who under a polygamous regime would probably never have obtained wives, and would thus have been prevented from procreating their inferior species. That in polygamous times, the wives, from a spirit of emulation, tried to rear their children and succeeded in doing so, and that it was not at all uncommon for a man to rear 10 or 12 children. That the people who practiced polygamy, the chiefs, were better able to maintain their wives in food and comforts than the men of lower ranks, who form the majority of monogamous husbands. That on the abolition of polygamy, the young girls were set free from the repression formerly exercised over them, and converted their freedom into license, a change which has borne fruit in the present age in the form of sexual irregularities and a dislike to marriage, and that when they enter that state, their duties as workers prevent them performing those of mothers. Here are a few official opinions cited in the report. Monogamy has increased the work of the women. They did not, perhaps, like all things connected with the state of polygamy, but on the whole, I believe, they like the incessant work entailed by monogamic life still less. The law, and that which Mr. Blythe, a little oddly, perhaps, describes as missionary monogamy, has altered this state of things. The wife has now to work at all times for her husband. She has, so she says, no rest, and that which she hates still more than work is the advances of her spouse, whether while on chante or nursing. The man abhors being tied to a woman. To both parties the idea is as repugnant as can possibly be conceived. If the man's advances are, however, persistent, the woman neglects her child and says the husband is killing it. Close quote. In another part of the report, there is mention made of a vice, which although common enough in European and Oriental countries, was, I believe, unknown to these people formerly. Quote, one writer states that the use of tobacco, coupled with the practice of self-abuse by men, women, boys and girls, is the most potent factor affecting the decrease of population. Close quote. Although there is only one mention of this vice, self-abuse, made in the report, I think it very likely to have been in practice among them at the time, for wherever we find a loose morality, this vice is almost sure to be prevalent. This would also account to a very large extent for the rapid decline of physique. Quote, the principal charge against tobacco is that pregnant women and nursing mothers smoke immoderately to the detriment of the infant and in many cases cause the death of the children. Close quote. These people were addicted to the use of tobacco long before they became British subjects, and at that time it would have been difficult to find healthier babies than theirs, so that although smoking is a bad habit, and one likely to cause a slight degeneration, it is hardly significant enough to offer as a solution of the problem. Some of the missionaries themselves seemed to recognize that a mistake had been made in forcing our ideas of morality on them, and acknowledged their belief that immorality was the principal factor in the decline of the race. The following is a remarkable admission made by one of them, Reverend W. Allen, Wesleyan missionary, which reflects credit on the integrity of the writer. Quote, "It is to be feared that a great deal of immorality at the present time exists with married women as well as single. I am inclined to think that since the introduction of Christianity and settled government, illicit intercourse among the sexes has very greatly increased, being released from the barbarous club law, and with no healthy public opinion among themselves on those matters to deter them, many have abused their liberty, using it as an occasion for lasciviousness." Close quote. He recommends that a pamphlet should be written in the native language and be distributed among them. This is most assuredly a practical admission of the failure of missionary enterprise. After 20 years of unopposed influence and the apparent conversion of the whole race to Christianity, this recommendation also shows the weakness of our moral code. Verbal demonstration in such matters is tabooed, and recourse must be had to an obscure pamphlet. What a difference between this picture and that of Dr. Seaman. Quote, "It is quite against Fijian ideas of delicacy that a man ever remains under the same roof with his wife or wives at night." Close quote. The Fijian, as a savage, was in many respects much superior to the Fijian as a British subject. Another missionary, Reverend H. Worrell, Wesleyan from Rewa, writes, quote, "As a missionary in charge of the largest circuit in Fiji, I am brought into contact with more than 2,800 natives. So, in considering the environments of these, I am probably considering what fairly applies to the whole race. I say, without doubt, that the most alarming factor in the sum total of the problem before us is the rapid increase of immorality. It is also impossible for me not to recognize the very alarming fact that a large percentage of this evil is to be laid to the charge of the high chiefs, some of whom hold responsible positions in the government. Immorality, so the history of nations declares, has always militated against the best interests of the human race. Since the abolition of club law, immorality has increased alarmingly. While I do not, for a moment, wish to imply that I advocate the re-establishment of this summary form of punishment, I do sincerely and respectfully advocate a more general application of the law." Close quote. It is a great mistake to think that immorality can be put down by any application of the law. If moral suasion fails, punishment is worse than useless. The Reverend W. Allen's suggestion of a pamphlet is a very practical remedy which appeals to the reason by pointing out to the natives how they suffer by giving way to their passions. They might be weaned from their vices and be taught self-respect, whereas punishment is degrading. Another writer, Reverend W. Slade, Wesleyan missionary, quote, "The Fijian mother is undoubtedly very careless of her offspring. The reason is to be found in her unstable character. The cares of maternity appear to become somewhat irksome to her. For long periods, she leaves her offspring in charge of children, who are themselves mere infants, and at such times the helpless child is wholly without nourishment. The chances of the Fijian mother bearing healthy children are lessened by her loose morality. I have been shocked to find at what an early age native girls surrender their virtue." Close quote. It would be almost impossible to imagine a greater contrast between the loose morality revealed by these letters and the former condition of these people. The devotion of the women to their children, both before and after birth, was almost phenomenal. In polygamous times, the woman separated from her husband as soon as she became enceinte, and the other women of the household used to guard the interests of the unborn child as jealously as if it were their own. It is a recorded fact that on one occasion, when a young chief was killed, one of his two wives, who were to be buried with him, was found to be with child, upon which another woman, in order to save the child, volunteered to take the young wife's place and was strangled in her stead. Such devotion to the unborn babe is perhaps unknown in any other history, and yet we now find these people sunk to the low condition depicted in the foregoing extracts. The Reverend A.J. Small was of opinion that the decrease of native population, quote, would have been apparent today even if they had never seen a European, close quote. How could the reverend gentleman make such a statement? Had he taken the trouble to look up the folklore of the people whose spiritual condition he had undertaken to improve, he would have found that their first important physiological trouble was an epidemic of dysentery which appeared with their first acquaintance with the white man. Prior to that, disease was, comparatively speaking, unknown. The Reverend F. Langham, chairman of the Wesleyan Mission, did not ascribe their decline to immorality, but thought that frequent abortions might have some influence in the matter. Mr. Langham, being one of the oldest missionaries in that part, one might have expected some enlightenment from him. Still, on the whole, we have gained some wonderful admissions from the missionaries, all tending to show the real cause of the Fijian decline. It seems hardly credible that such a fearless and warlike race could have been cowed down to the extent that they were, and in such a few years, had the main object of the Europeans been to bring them into utter subjection, they could not have adopted a more effectual plan. Yet the people who were the cause of this subjection were as much bewildered as his victims. Lord Stanmore, formerly Sir A. H. Gordon, the first governor of Fiji, was invited to attend the missionary conference at St. James's Hall on May the 31st, 1894, to give an account of the effect of missionary enterprise in that part of the world. To judge from the report published by the Daily Chronicle on the following day, those who expected to hear something laudatory of missionary influence must have experienced a shock at the tone of Lord Stanmore's address. In describing village life, he said, quote, "In the centre of the village is the cricket field, a desolate expanse of dry earth, on one side of which is the church, a wooden, barn-like building. If entered, it will be found filled with crazy benches. Beyond them rises a huge octagonal pulpit, in which, if the day be Sunday, we shall find the native minister arrayed in a greenish-black swallow-tailed coat, a neckcloth once white, and a pair of spectacles, which he probably does not need, preaching to a congregation, the male portion of which is dressed in much the same manner as himself, while the women are dressed in old, battered hats and bonnets, and shapeless gowns like bathing dresses, or, it may be, crinolines of an early type. Chiefs of influence and women of high birth, who in their native dress would look, and do look, the ladies and gentlemen that they are, by their Sunday finery given the appearance of attendance on Jack in the Green. Hard by is the school, where, owing to the proscription of native clothing, the children appear in tattered rags, under the tuition of a master, whose garments resemble those of an Irish scarecrow, and they are probably repeating a list of English counties, or some similar information equally useful to a Polynesian islander. The whole life of these village folk is one piece of unreal acting. Their faces have, for the most part, an expression of discontent. They move about silently and joylessly, rebels at heart to the restrictive coils upon them. They have good ground for their dissatisfaction. At the time when I visited the village, I have, especially in my eye, it was punishable by fine and imprisonment to wear native clothing. Punishable by fine and imprisonment to make native cloth. Punishable by fine and imprisonment to smoke tobacco. Punishable by fine and imprisonment to make the native beverage, kava. Punishable by fine and imprisonment to wear long hair or a garland of flowers. Punishment by fine and imprisonment to wrestle or play ball. Punishable by fine and imprisonment to build a native fashioned house. Punishable not to wear shirt and trousers, and in certain localities, coat and shoes also. And in addition to laws enforcing a strict puritanical observance of the Sabbath, it was punishable by fine and imprisonment to bathe on Sundays. In some other places, bathing on Sundays was punishable by flogging, and to my knowledge, women have been flogged for no other offence by order of a native teacher, whose action was by no means so decidedly disapproved of by his white superior as it should have been. Men in such circumstances are ripe for revolt, and sometimes the revolt comes. Close quote. What a misery such a life must have been to those people who had formerly enjoyed absolute freedom. Can it be wondered at, under the circumstances, that they gave way to immorality, if only to break the monotony of such an existence? However, the whole weight of the responsibility rests with us. We, however reluctant to admit it, have forced our inferior system, inferior from a physiological aspect, on them. And it is our duty to try and rectify the evil. To revert to their old system would be impossible, unless we give them back their lands. Even then, the prevalence of erotomania would prevent the return to their former innocent life. By innocent life, I do not mean cannibalism and club law, but innocence from a moral aspect. My aim in dwelling on the troubles of these people is to point an object lesson from which we may derive some inkling as to the cause of our own. We are so much in the habit of assuming that savage races are devoid of all reason, that we are surprised to find them in possession of laws of any description, much more so to find them with regulations superior to our own, as some of them certainly are. Take, for instance, the cessation of intercourse during the periods of gestation and nursing, a most exemplary rule, a rule which would make a vast difference in our infant mortality if adopted by us. Similar rules to this were in force in different parts of Africa, according to Mr. Winwood Reed and others. Quote, the child is introduced into the world without medical aid and is cordially welcomed. The mother is treated with great respect and is exempt from all labour while she continues to suckle her child, which she continues to do while her milk lasts. During this time, and almost from the moment that impregnation becomes apparent, the mother no longer cohabits with her husband. Otherwise, say the natives, the child would be born sickly or crippled, in which case it would be killed, and the milk would be spoiled. Close quote. I know of no civilized place where the common practice is equal to this. It seems to me the very acme of philosophy. And yet we go to these people with our assumption of superiority, and instead of being wise enough to inquire into their habits of life, we force our creeds, superstitions, and vices on them, whether they wish it or not. End of chapter 4.